excited to ask Gifrid to give us an introduction to the Tensor Network perspective on Reimerization Group and also some of its application possibly for gravity models. So thank you very much.
Excellent. So first I would like to start by asking who of you is in quantum gravity?
Yeah, it seems like...
So I was very confused by the question. Okay, so like 3.5? Okay, so I wasn't very sure how to present it, so I've been asked to explain a little bit what we do with TensorNet, especially in the context now MET is being mentioned in the context of ABS CFT. So what I thought I would do is I'll introduce MET in the context of condensed matter in a simple way, and then if we get that right, then speculation related to ABS CFT. I'll tell you why, make explicit why people are talking about MET in the context of ABS CFT, but I'm not qualified to make any concrete claim there. So so there's gonna be a condensed matter talk for quantum gravity people, except that there's not a lot of quantum gravity people. All right. I've broken the talk into three pieces. First, I want to talk about the renormalization group. That's going to be the standard renormalization group, just to agree on the language and the notation. And I want to talk about tensor networks, and finally, I want to mix the two. Okay. So we're talking about this tensor network renormalization, which is just doing the renormalization groups on tensor networks. And what's the basic question? What are we trying to do? So we consider a large number of microscopic degrees of freedom, and we want to understand how they organize themselves collectively, so to give rise to emergent phenomena or emergent properties. And this could be a metal or an insulator, or it could be a superconductor or a superfluid. Or there are many other pictures you can get nowadays from internet, so I fill the whole page. But the basic question is clear, right? We start with a microscopic description of the system. We would like to be able to deterministically derive the emergent phenomenon. So the problem is following, we have a microscopic Hamiltonian. What we would like to have is its ground state. We would like to be able to characterize its ground state, or more generally, low energy excitations, or etc. Or alternatively, but closely related to that, would be to get a Euclidean path integral by means of which it just means the trace of exponential of minus h. And these are complex objects in general. So I'll to keep things extremely concrete, I'll have an example in mind all the time, and this is going to be the one-dimensional quantumizing model. So that's going to be a spin chain with nearest neighbor coupling and some magnetic field. And then in this case, so it's a one-dimensional system, so you can think that this Euclidean path integral is an object that lives in two dimensions. One is the size of the system, and the other one is beta. Okay, so that would be this Euclidean path integral for a one-dimensional system of length L. And then difficult questions we would like to be able to answer from here, at least in this case we know the answer already, so let's remind us what this is. So we may want to understand the phase diagram. As we change the magnetic field, we'll see that the spontaneous magnetization goes from being non-zero to zero, some critical value of the magnetic field and so on, right? So we would like to be able to extract the collective behavior of the ground state or of this system at zero temperature. All right, but I will continuously make reference also to an attached two-dimensional classical system. You may also be well aware of that. I just felt like I should say it. So we have this, in this case, we would have the two-dimensional classical Ising model. And in this case, this would be a partition function, the usual partition function. And so this object lives in two dimensions. In the sense that we have two lengths, the length of the system in two dimensions. And then if you look at the phase diagram, it's identical, and there is a good reason for that, which is that these two models are essentially identical. or dual to each other. I mean, this will be the example that I'll be referring to, but you know, I'm a frustrated person. The ones that I would like to talk about are QCD or solve generic quantum chemistry problems or material science problems. Okay, so this is the simplest example of something much broader that we would like to be able to analyze with the renormalization group. Okay, so was in this talk, what is the renormalization group? In this talk, the renormalization group is, yes?
Just to orient ourselves, are we always in equilibrium in your talk?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, simplest possible scenario.
Always. Okay.
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 Excellent. So then, yeah, let's talk about the renormalization group. Oh. Yeah. I was wondering why I'm so comfortable today. Usually there is a voice, right, that tells you.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to think about the Hamiltonian as being Hamiltonian space of couplings. In the case of the Ising model, we have two non-zero couplings given by the strength of the nearest neighbor term and the magnetic field. But we could think that this really is embedded in a much larger space of Hamiltonians with all possible local couplings we can imagine. And then what we want to do is we want to study how this Hamiltonian changes with the scale of observation. I'll mention what I mean by that, but it's in the usual sense. And so if we change the scale of observation, we expect to see that our Hamiltonian describes a flow in the space of possible couplings. Okay, so maybe initially we have a Hamiltonian. This is a projection, in a two-dimensional projection of this space of couplings. And this is just illustrating the usual idea of the renormalization group. So this is useful because, well, we can use this flow in the space of couplings to identify different phases with different fixed points, stable fixed points for each of the phases, and then maybe a critical fixed point separating the two phases. Okay, so standard stuff. Okay?
So your flow is always oriented to the IR or UV?
We could reverse the errors, but.
But in your talk?
In my talk, we're going to long distances, low energies. IR. Better. Okay, so what do I mean by a change of a scale? Well, what we actually mean is some form of Korsenian transformation. And we can go back to the guys who started talking about these things. And Leo Kalernoff proposed in real space that, for instance, in a classical partition function in two dimensions, we would take a block of three spins. We would look at where they are pointing. And by majority vote, we would decide that if most of them are pointing now, we'll replace the three spins with a big spin that is pointing now. Okay? That is an example of transformation, Korsenian transformation, that allows us to go from a system at some length scale to a system at a larger length scale. Microscopic, the basic degrees of freedom have changed from one scale to another. All right, so, and then we have maybe the most known in field theory approach, with the renormalization group ideas as performed in quantum field theory would be this idea that we have our Euclidean path integral as where we integrate over all possible modes in momentum space with some cutoff. And the idea is that we want to take this integration and break it into two pieces. One is, I said, we will consider a new cutoff lambda prime before it was lambda. And we will integrate modes between these two cutoffs, the old one and the new one. And so this will give rise to some effective Hamiltonian reaction. And then we will just take the original Euclidean path integral. We will write it instead of as an integral over all possible momenta. We will restrict the integral now all the way to the new cutoff. And we'll use this effective action, which effectively performs the rest of the integration, has already performed the rest of the integration. Great, so my talk is going to steal all these ideas from the renormalization group flow. But what we want to do is we want to devise, this is the engine, this cosine transformation is the engine that you can change, right? To generate a renormalization group flow. So Kadanoff proposes something, Wilson proposes something else, and you know, why not something else? Well, is there a need also to propose a different approach? There is no way we can criticize this work, but there are questions that you can raise. For instance, why majority vote? Is that because spins are a democratic system and they vote, or is there a more less emotional way of dealing with many body systems in real space? And in this case here, there might be questions about the locality of, this is the basis of perturbative approaches, but there might be a question of how to generalize this to non-perturbative context, okay? How to apply renormalization group a la Wilson, or subsequent improvement or developments by Polchinski and others in the non-perturbative context. And I've gone a little bit through the literature, and there are many proposals. There have been proposals. They've been debated in the around 2005. You know, it's really nice. You should go and look at the blogs, people insulting each other. But I don't know that it's settled.
But the Polchinski equation is a non-perturbative equation.
Right. I'll refer you to Wikipedia. It's a nice link, and then they are recording this. I'll do it offline. yes. So let's talk later. There are people debate, and they say exactly why they think that's not a that's non-perturbative. That is not a non-perturbative approach. So why these proposals are only perturbative? Okay. But not my business. So what we would like to do is. We want to focus on a real space approach. We want it to be real space because that's what we know how to do, okay? Not because momentum space is worse. We would like to have a non-perturbative RG approach where we produce a sequence of increasingly cosine Hamiltonians which retain locality. They are local if we started with a local Hamiltonian. And we would like to do this with universal cosine rules. So we don't want that if these are spins, we have majority vote. If they are bosons, they have some other rule. We would like to have something that is just based on energetics, if possible. And since it's a wish list, we would like to solve QCD. But what I want to tell you today is how far we got over the last 10 years in this forum. And the first thing I can say is that we have reformulated the RG using quantum information tools and concepts, quantum circuits, entanglement, and you'll see that. But I want to be clear that I would not be telling you about this if we had just reformulated something. Okay? It's not about reformulating, it's about whether after reformulating you can gain new insights that allow you to make progress. So one thing that occurred as a result of these studies is that we obtain an efficient representation of ground state wave functions, and this is what I'll describe later on. It's called the mirror, which is a variational ansatz that seems to capture the essence of most ground states, at least in 1+1 dimensions, including critical systems. And also, we hope that in larger dimensions. But really, what I would like to discuss is this universal non-perturbative real space RG approach that we think we have obtained. And the key ingredient really came from starting to talk about the renormalization group in terms of entanglement. And the key ingredient then is that we understood that what needed to be done is to remove short-range entanglement. Okay?
This mirror, I think it explicitly breaks translational symmetry. So do you think this problem will be kind of biased in high dimension, like in 2D system? So in 1D, I think it's not a so big a problem. But for 2D system, because they are all kind
right.
of...
Right, so any RG scheme that I can think of in real space will break translational invariance because you have to make a decision of what sites you block together.
Yeah, but Google Sense idea is not a variational wave function. It's a space-time Lagrangian. So when you think about this.
Okay. Yeah. We'll get there. Okay. What I want to say is that any cosine transformation will break translation invariants. In real space, cosine transformation will break translation invariants. Unless you can do it in the continuum, there are proposals to do this in the continuum. Nevertheless, what we've seen numerically is that this is not an issue in the sense that these cosgrainian schemes, these real space RG schemes, come with a refinement parameter which controls, well, the more you spend, the more computational resources you spend into the simulation, the more accurate the results are, and in particular the first thing you see is that you are recovering translation invariance if you are trying to constrain a system which was translation invariant.
Right, if we're doing space-time, I agree, but if we're doing variational wave function, it could be
bad. Can we wait first for the definition? Some people don't know what the MARA is.
Yeah.
Could we wait for the discussion once these things have been introduced?
Okay, so what I wanted to stress though from the beginning, so that we have some, you know what to pay attention to, it will be this removal of short-range entanglement. That's going to be a key idea, okay? And yes, we have not yet solved QCV. So tensor networks, and I want to talk about tensor networks, and this is a broader subject, and I just want to say that this is a collective effort involving many, many, many people, and that it started in condensed matter. We were trying to devise new variational approaches for wave functions, and there has been some success there. The problem is that it really got a bit out of control, and there have been very important progress in theoretical condensed matter and the classification of gap phases by Zheng Sheng and his collaborators, where part of the idea was that tensor networks were used to describe possible ground states, and then the classification of possible ground states was possible thanks to that. Anyway, the thing extended also to material science. Simons Foundation is supporting a program to use tensor, including tensor networks for material science. Quantum chemists are now using tensor networks. Classical statistical mechanics, also you will see that there is this duality between quantum systems and classical systems. And the thing I want to talk about today is renormalization group, and also there is a little bit of holography that came out of this. Okay, but this is, this is the effort of many, many people, collective effort of many people. So let me start then by introducing these tensor networks. What we want to do is to efficiently represent a many-body wave function of n spins. So if we want to do that in a generic case, what we need to do, we can expand this wave function of n quantum spins in terms of some local basis by using 2 to the n complex coefficients. Okay? And what's a tensor network? Well, in one drawing, this is a tensor network, and we're going to I need to explain what this drawing means, of course, so that's what I'm going to try now. So first, let me introduce this graphical notation. If you see a circle from today, a circle is a complex number, okay? If you see a circle with a leg, that is a vector. It's a complex number labeled by an index, so you run different values of the index and you get different complex numbers. That's a collection of complex numbers. If you see a circle with two legs, matrix, okay? And so on. If you see a circle with many legs, it's a tensor with many indices. Okay? So, for instance, this guy here represents this exponentially many coefficients which are organized with n indices. So you should see n legs out here. Okay? Perfect. So the second bit of notation that I have to introduce, and then we're done, is if you see that there are two such objects shedding a leg, then there is a sum over this index in the middle. Okay? So for instance, this thing here is a matrix, has two indices. This thing here is a matrix, has two indices, and they share an index. Well, then that means there is a matrix multiplication, okay? And the result, therefore, is it's another matrix. Okay, so another example would be this. This is a number which could be the product of a matrix with a vector and another vector. And then those who were psi last year should not answer this. It's always the same question. If you see this, and if you've been paying attention to the rule, can you tell me what that is?
Is that a trace?
Sorry, I couldn't hear.
Is that a trace?
A trace of what?
matrix.
Okay, perfect. It's the trace of a product of four matrices. Excellent. Okay, so that's the notation. Now we need to go back up here, but before, what's the point? Why do we have to start drawing things? One answer is it's a lot of fun, but maybe we want to compare these two expressions. Okay, if they tell me that I have a number that looks like this, I kind of get a bit lost with indices. I need to really, A is multiplied with B, second index with first index, and so on, right? Actually, all the information about this connectivity is contained already in the tensor network.
There's a comment about history. This is usually attributed to Penrose, who wrote a paper in which he used his diagrammatics and then extended to the case where the trace of the identity was negative number.
Okay, so I'm aware that that these kind of drawings have been used a lot. I'm not completely sure that I'm using them exactly in the same way that previous people.
We'll see.
So to me, this drawing really, that's all it is, right? It's just a multi-index array of complex coefficients.
Well, usually what people do is that they keep track of what is the tensor used. So they would put A, B, C, D on your drawing.
Oh, yeah.
So that's
what people do really depends on what people, yeah.
And that has been, that's used in the same
way. Perfect. So then we understand this notation.
So far it's identical to the other notations.
Perfect. I wish everybody would be so, So then I can go back to explaining what this expression means. We have this object here with many legs. That means this object is exponentially large in the number of legs. And we want to write it as a product of a small number, a product of tensors, of a small tensors. Small in the sense that it have a small number of legs each. Okay? So why would we want to do this? On the left-hand side, we have an object that is characterized by 2 to the n, so exponentially many parameters, complex coefficients. On the right-hand side, what we have is n different small objects, where each object has at most, say, in this case, 3 legs. And so these are tensors with 3 indices. And if I assume that each index takes a number of values, say, chi values, which is independent of n, then I have obtained a description in terms of just n order n coefficients. Okay? So I'm not claiming that all vectors, all tensors here can be written in this way. I'm just claiming that we can use this to write efficiently some tensors on this side. Okay? That we can compactly write 2 to the n, obviously not independent, but 2 to the n complex coefficients in this way. So what's the theory? We have the Hilbert space of n spins. It's a huge place. It's exponential. The dimension of this Hilbert space is exponentially large in n. And we're just going to do the usual variational thing. We're going to restrict our attention to a small corner of this huge Hilbert space. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, it turns out that by studying entanglement, it has become clear that ground states of local Hamiltonians are also not random states in the whole Hilbert space, but they actually occupy a small corner. Okay? One can argue that ground states of local Hamiltonians do not depend on exponentially many parameters, they depend only on order n parameters. And so there is hope, but just hope, that there is a non-trivial overlap between the region of the Hilbert space that we would like to be describing and the region of the Hilbert space that we can describe with this tensor network. Okay? It's a hope. And then there are many reasons to be hopeful. Okay, so I described what the tensor network is in general, just put together a bunch of tensors. And now I want to specialize to a particular example, and this is the multiscale and time and renormalization ansatz, or MIRA. And the first thing I want to say about this tensor network is that this is for a one-dimensional system. So you see the open indices are down here. So you could imagine that what we're trying to do is describe the ground state of a spin chain. Okay, for each index, you should think that there is a spin. And then this is a tensor network. If we multiply all the bond indices together, we'll just get some large tensor with exponentially many complex numbers. Okay, that will be our wave function expressed in a local radius. All right, so interpretation answers for a one-dimensional system, but you can see that it's organized in two dimensions. There is the physical dimension, and then there is an extra dimension, which I'll be referring as the scale dimension, or the scale direction, or also, in some sense, time. We'll see that. So the idea of this ansatz is that, as a variational ansatz, is that you can have variational parameters down here, and they will be naturally attached to microscopic properties of the system occurring locally in this region, or you could store your variation. There are also variational parameters up here. And these variational parameters will actually decide properties of the system at a much larger length scale. Okay? So instead of having a bunch of variational parameters all together, you just spread them and distribute them not only in space but also in scale. And then what I want to discuss with you now is that this tensor network is secretly both a quantum circuit, okay, it is a quantum circuit, and also a renormalization group transformation. There is a renormalization group transformation hiding in this tensor network. So that's what I want to discuss next. Let's see first the quantum circuit.
Is there a group whose representations govern the systematics of the labeling?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Is there a group underlying the choice? So in the uses of this kind of notation that I'm familiar with quantum gravity, there's an overall group. If it was QCD, it would be SU3, whose representation theory governs the choice of the indices and the kinds of tensors that can appear.
So if we were talking about a system down here that had some symmetry, for instance, if this was the IC model and it has Z2 symmetry, then it would make sense to organize the indices according to representations of Z2.
Yeah, so that's
so we could do that. We do that. But this is not the fundamental aspect of this construction.
I see.
So it can be done, but that's not the point. Okay? Sorry, is there another question? Okay, so let me show you that this thing here, let me do the following. Let me first describe the tensors that we have. So we have, you can see that we have two types of tensors. There are tensors with four legs. Okay, so for instance, this one has four legs. And then there are tensors with three legs. For instance, this tensor has three legs. Okay, so I'm going to refer to the tensors with four legs as disentanglers, and the tensors with three legs as isometries. And what will happen is, I didn't tell you, but these tensors actually are constrained. There is a constraint on these tensors. They have to be unitary transformations between two spins into two spins, from two spins to two spins. Okay, so they act on the Hilbert space of two spins unitarily. All right, and these isometries are such that can be understood as the result of taking another two-body gate or two-spin gate, another unitary transformation of the spins, but fixing one of the input legs to fix state zero. Okay? So let's do that. Let's replace, what I'm doing now is I'm replacing every isometry with a two-body gate. We have it here. And then I want you to realize that what we're doing here is we're taking a completely unentangled state, that this one here. So we're starting, you can think of this ansatz as taking a completely unentangled state of n spins, which appear at the top but also in the middle, and we apply many gates to them, and you, collectively I'm going to call this a quantum circuit U. So we take a non-entangled state and we entangle it by means of all these gates. Okay. So what we can see, according to this picture, right? So, is it clear? The input is a product state of all these unentangled spins, and the output is some entangled state, which we will use as a ground, as an approximation to a ground state. Okay. And the variational parameters are on all these gates. We only have explained how the gates are connected with each other. We haven't decided what the content of the gates, what the gates are doing, what unitary transformations they are implementing. Good. So the first observation, I'm still not talking about what individual gates are doing, but you can see the following already, that entanglement in this final state is not introduced at once, but it's introduced in different steps. So we can think that from a if this was a quantum circuit, then there would be a computational time running down in this direction. And so what we can think is that we have a completely an entangled state, and then we entangle it a little bit. We start with two spins, we entangle a little bit, then we add fresh spins, and we also entangle them, and so on. We sequentially introduce entanglement. And the entanglement that we introduce up here will be at a largest length scale in the system, whereas the entanglement that we introduce, say, here, will only correspond to a small length scale in the system. Okay? Good. So that's the sense in which I said that the mirror was secretly a quantum circuit. Yes? So
how does the disentangler act on vacuum, tensor vacuum, 0, 0?
I'm sorry?
How does the disentangler act on vacuum and vacuum?
So this is the vacuum of one spin, one single spin. So imagine it's a spin 1/2. We have two states, 0 and 1. This is the vacuum of another spin. And now you look at these two spins, starting from the vacuum of the two spins, and you just apply a generic, whatever unitary transformation you want.
Is it the same at all?
It doesn't have to be the same. Okay.
So just some arbitrary unitary matrix. It's like
at this point, everything, yes. Every single circle here corresponds to an arbitrary unitary matrix on two spins. That right?
But it's the same unitary matrix throughout?
It doesn't have to be. At this point, it doesn't have to be.
Will it be in the application?
If you had, for instance, that this is a transition invariant system, then the choice of choosing every single row, all the unitaries in that row the same, would be justified. If this was a scale invariant system on top, so if it's scale invariant and transition invariant, then it would be justified that you put the same disentangler everywhere. And the same isometry everywhere. Okay.
But even you choose all the this unitary, they are the same at each layer, it's still not translating numerically.
Right? That's right. Choosing, thanks for the comment. So choosing all the disentanglers to be the same in one layer or every layer, right? Making this choice does not guarantee that the final state that you have here is translation invariant. And this is obvious from the structure of the circuit, right? Because, say, this side here is not equivalent to this side here with respect to the upper structure. Every time you have a tree, right? I don't know if that's obvious, but if I just had a tree to simplify the discussion, right, it's a simplified version. So this leg here, this spin here, with respect to this ansatz, does not have the same relation to the ansatz that this leg here. In the sense that, for instance, I don't know, in order to go to the next neighbor in this direction, I would have to go all the way here. Whereas in order to go to the next neighbor from this one, I just have to go. Go up one level and down. Okay, so the structure of the tensor network explicitly breaks translation invariance. Okay, so we're done with the quantum circuit, and now I told you it was also secretly an RC transformation, and what I want to do here is explain what that means. So first I want to go back to Kalanov and take his idea of let's take say two spins together in order to constrain the system. But I want to do it a la White, Steve White, who said, let's not just ask the spins what they want to do this weekend, but let's say that we are going to take the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces for each of the spins, and we're just going to look at that tensor product, and we'll decide for some such space within that tensor product, and that such space will define the Hilbert space for our effective side. Okay, so we're going to take two sides into one, but we're going to leave it quite general here, and we will decide variationally according to some prescription what's the best that we should put here. But this looked like the isometries I was using before already. Okay, so this approach thinking in terms, as White proposed, thinking in terms of a variational optimization for the Coriolanian transformation, that's a very important step forward. And that, in, since 1992, that's how simulations of one-dimensional systems work. What White proposed was not exactly this scheme, but he did propose to use variational optimization, and it's been a very, very successful story since then. What I want to discuss, though, is a slightly different Coriolanian scheme, which adds to this one, in the sense that we will add, so instead of just, say, taking these two spins together into one, instead of just using an isometry, before taking them together, we'll disentangle this spin with its nearest neighbor, or we'll allow for a unitary transformation of this spin with its nearest neighbor, and of this spin with its nearest neighbor, okay? So before blocking, before turning two spins into one, we'll let the spins that are gonna be turned into one, into a pair, we'll let them talk or unitarily evolve with their nearest neighbors. And why is that interesting? Well, I want to justify the choice in terms of entanglement. I want to look at the following. Suppose that what we're trying to constrain, this is just a time model, but allow me to focus on a very simple time model. Suppose that we want to constrain a state that in particular is such that these two spins are entangled with each other. Okay, there is some entanglement between these two spins. Then if I am allowed to apply an isometry here, if I have two spins that are entangled to each other and the two spins become one, the entanglement is gone, right? Entanglement is something that is shared between distant spins, not within the same spin. So this is good because we could argue that short-range entanglement is a microscopic property that we want to get rid of. It is entangling microscopic degrees of freedom at short distances. This is a property that a renormalization group transformation should be getting rid of. And down here we can do the same. So we still have the isometry, so we'll be able to remove short-range entanglement. However, imagine now that the short-range entanglement is between these two spins, between two spins that are going to become coarse-grained into different spins. Okay. So if we apply this, so if we had such short-range entanglement on this spin chain, and we apply coarse-grained transformation such as this one, then after constraining the system, this short range entanglement will still be there, except that it will have been promoted from short range to longer range. Okay, it will be short range in the new length scale. It will be nearest neighbor. It was nearest neighbor before, it's nearest neighbor now. Just that nearest neighbor now is corresponds to longer length scale in the system. So this looks a bit fishy. Okay? Looks fishy because it means that some of the entanglement really short-range entanglement in our system survives the coarse-graining. And now we iterate, and you could go to arbitrary large system sizes, and you would realize that, well, we still remember where we started from. We still have memory of microscopic details of our system. So that's precisely the point of introducing these entanglers here, these unitary transformations. We're just going to use them so that if you give me two entangled spins, I'll apply a unitary transformation that will disentangle them, okay? And it will be gone.
But you said that in 1D, the top scheme works really well.
Yeah, you have to be, so yes, I said that.
So what's the, is there an issue because you have this propagating entanglement?
So it's an issue if you want conceptually first, if you want to realize the ideas of the renormalization group flow, you would want an effective description that does not remember where it's coming from except for the universal data, mm-hmm. right? And so this way of proceeding, imagine that you're integrating, you decide that in the Wilson formulation, you decide in momentum space, you decide that you are going to integrate out from modes from some the old cutoff to the new cutoff, but you forget to integrate some of them. So you take that with you in the next effective action. And this is what's happening here. Your effective description of the system, if this was the initial lattice, this lattice prime, this effective lattice, has too much in it. It contains details that belong to the previous scale.
But in practice, It's so not a problem.
Okay, so now in practice. In practice, it really depends on what you want to do. If you take a system that after considering 20 sites or 100 sites, you can already extract thermodynamic properties, then you constrain a few steps, you accumulate a little bit of short-range entanglement, you are still within the range of simulations that you can afford given current computational power, and you're fine. You can extract information from the system. And this is actually a very useful way of extracting information from the system. Okay. So the MRT, which was proposed by Steve White, this still dominates the 1D market of simulations of one-dimensional, one-dimensional spin change. But if what you want to do is to study a system where there are many different length scales involved, so say near criticality or at criticality, or a flow from one critical system to another one, don't even try to use such schemes.
People do, right?
Not to flow from one critical point to another one. Not that I know. Did you have a question?
This is maybe a silly question, but just right when if you're coarse grinding from many spins down to one, and you're looking at an amount of entanglement right between two bits, which is only like two qubits, which is only going to be one bit of entanglement. Isn't it just going to be much less entanglement? You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe.
That's not sufficient? Okay.
But what I would like is that if I start with a state that only has short-range entanglement,
yeah,
and this is a property of that length scale,
yeah.
So imagine that you I'm saying entanglement, imagine correlations. If you have a system that only has very short-range correlations, when you coarse grain, you expect the correlation length to become smaller, right?
Right.
You don't expect the correlation length to become constant, I mean to remain the same under coarse graining. Effectively, it's being halved. So here that will happen. You will still have nearest neighbor entanglement.
I guess I just would expect some sort of decay, and that you're saying that it's not sufficient.
This is because I'm using a toy model where I'm using just maximum entangled qubits, say, or spins.
Sure. Okay.
Good. So that's the story. We want to introduce these entanglers to completely remove short range entanglement. Yes?
Yeah, so just to check in another language. If you're using real qubits, then the entangled state is a singlet in the product Hilbert space, and your disentangler would be the projection operator onto the rest of the Hilbert space, which is the spin one.
The disentangler?
Disentangler, if you decompose the product of two spins into a spin zero and a spin one part.
Right, so this is a singlet.
Would be the projection operator into the spin.
No, no, this is not a projector operator, it's a unitary transformation. So I would take this maximally entangled state, this singlet, and I would unitarily transform it into a product state. Say up.
I see. So it's not a projection.
It's not a projection. It's a unitary transformation. In particular, I can reverse it and get back my state if I change my mind and wanted to uncoarse grain. Fine grain or something. That would be changing the algos.
Do you optimize that as well? Yes, I mean, a fixed is
absolutely
a fixed.
Absolutely. We have to optimize everything. Okay, good. But I just wanted the basic ideas clear first before we start. Okay, so what do we have then? Well, we have this mirror can be understood as an energy flow, or as defining an energy flow in the space of ground state wave functions. Okay, so suppose that this is a good description of the ground state. Okay, suppose, I'm not saying that you have to believe it is, but suppose it is. Then what we have here is not just one ground state, but actually this is a ground state for the constraint system. And this is the ground state for the system after coarse-graining twice, and so on. So we have actually not just one wave function, but a collection of wave functions. Okay, and then we could study. So instead of studying the flow in the space of Hamiltonians, we could study the flow in the space of these tensors. Okay, and you may wonder why do you want to do that? Well, actually, let's say you can do that. Okay. And it turns out that if you really wanted, in particular, you could study when you have a fixed point wave function, and we've been using this for critical systems. It's very, very useful. And so this type of approaches have been used and have been shown to be useful to describe topological order in 2+1 dimension, and also quantum criticality 1+1. Okay. But if you really wanted a flow in the space of Hamiltonians, I have good news for you, because this coarse grain transformation, it's a map of your initial Hilbert space of the uncoherent lattice into the coherent lattice. So why don't we apply this to a Hamiltonian? We could imagine your Hamiltonian is made of local terms. Let's take one of these local terms. How does it look like? Well, in the current notation, would be identity for most of spins, and then we have three spins that are where there is a non-trivial operator acting on them, and then the rest of the spins are again identity. Okay, so this would be a term in a local Hamiltonian. H is the sum of such terms. Okay, so let's look at what happens to this particular term under cosgraining. So how do we cosgrain? Well, we apply the cosgraining transformation, and also its conjugate. Okay, so this thing here now is an operator acting on the cosgraining system. You see, it goes from a number of legs, which is half the number of legs we started from, to that same number of legs, right? So this is a map from the cosgraining lattice to the cosgraining lattice. Now, it doesn't look very local, right? It's a mess. It's not, it used to be the identity everywhere, except on three sides, and now it's a mess everywhere. But remember that these guys are unitary transformations, and this is the conjugate, U and U dagger. Being unitary means that this is equal to the identity, so we can remove them. And remember, the isometries were also secretly unitaries. So actually, you can simplify this into this. Okay, all these tensors here disappear, and you suddenly see, oh, this is identity. It's not the identity on three spins, and then it's the identity elsewhere. Okay, so we just mapped a local operator into a local operator. And now you do that for all the terms in the Hamiltonian, and you start with H being a sum of local terms, and you end up with H prime being a sum also of local terms. Nothing else. No, we didn't generate arbitrary long range interactions or anything like that. Purely local. Okay? That really is a local RC transformation.
Can you do that transformation without knowing what the fixed point wave function is? Because so you first have to determine what the tensors are, right?
Let's not worry about that. I'm saying if you have these tensors, if you had a good description of the ground state, you could use it to cosgrain the Hamiltonian. If you really all you care about is to get an effective Hamiltonian, you could do it in here. Okay. Good. So it's a good time for a summary, and probably the time is over anyway. Yes. But let's see what we've seen. So I've introduced this concrete tensor network. There are many possibilities, many other tensor networks. I've been talking about this one, which has plenty of additional parameters, but they are distributed both in space and scale. And this was secretly a quantum circuit, and we said we ended up with the sentence, entanglement is introduced in the ground, in the ground state, at different length scales. So it's this entanglement isometry, we're introducing entanglement at different length scales. And we've seen that it was also secretly an RC transformation that allowed us to cosgrain, we saw that it defined a flow in the space of wave functions, where the key was that we were removing short-range entanglement, but also it allowed us to preserve locality when we tried to cosgrain Hamiltonians. Okay, that's what we've seen. And so, you know, blah, blah, blah. So why are we talking about this?
For critical system, what's the precise meaning of remove short-range entanglement? Because if it's a component field theory, there is no particular length scale. If I'm thinking about quantum field theory, so.
When you see a lattice here?
Suppose you apply this wave function for a critical point.
Yeah, I understood your question. My answer was a question. Do you see a lattice here? That gives you a cutoff, right? There is an explicit ultraviolet cutoff. This gives you a length scale. And as you cosgrain, you get a new cutoff. So you have a cutoff at every single length scale. That's the length scale you are asking.
So how should I think of this in terms of field theory? Because in conformal field theory, there's no particular cutoff. Right? So you don't need to introduce.
No, but we're talking about a system on the lattice, which may have a continuum limit described as by a CFT. So I didn't introduce the lattice. The lattice was given to me from the beginning. And I managed to constrain the systems to larger length scale. There is no trick, right? We have an initial ultraviolet cutoff. This gives you a length scale.
Right.
And if we constrain, we get a new length scale every time.
But at best view, it's not a real conformal field theory because it's kind of some UV regulation for the CFT.
Yes.
So, but
yes.
I'm talking about some intermediate layer. So suppose cut in the middle, So that's supposedly already approaching some CFT fixed point. So if you cut it in the middle, what's the meaning of short range here?
It's there is a length scale given by the cutoff at in the middle, and that is what I call short range entanglement with respect to that length scale.
You're, to put it a different way, you're not at the critical point, you're on a critical trajectory. And it's good enough to study the critical trajectories. You don't have to sit at the critical points. But if you sit at the critical points, there's nowhere to go.
You have a picture, a field theory picture, right, in mind.
But you have a field theory picture always comes with a cutoff.
But we have just defined here.
I'm agreeing with you. A field theory picture always comes with a cutoff. There's no such thing as a quantum field theory that doesn't have implicitly a cutoff.
Right, but I'm trying to make an extra point, which is that we are defining energy flow in the space of wave function on the lattice. And with respect to this, flow, we can reach a fixed point on the lattice.
Sure.
And that's what we will do next. So what I wanted to mention briefly is that, well, this is a construction. You know, it has many colors, and it looks like, you know, you spend your time drawing. But why is this structure interesting? And so let me go back to the critical Lysi model. This is really old work, 2008. But this is an example of the things we could do. So we take, and now it's this question of how do we determine the variational parameters? Well, it's energy minimization. It's complicated. I'm not going to go into it. But basically, you ask the question, what disentangler and isometry do I have to put here to lower the energy of the expectation value of the energy? And if you do it, if you assume scale invariants from the start and transition invariants, then you replace all the tensors by just you have one disentangler and one isometry all over the place. It's copies of the same guy. So you have a small number of variational parameters. You are dealing with an infinite system from the start, okay, the wave function of an infinite system. And then you can minimize the energy. And the type of results you get is, instead of talking about the ground state energy and how accurate it is, I want to talk directly about scaling dimensions, which probably you'll agree that are the hard quantities to extract on the lattice. And so, for instance, what we have in the IC model, we have a set of a local primary fields, identity, the spin, and the energy density, and then also some non-local primary fields, the disorder and the fermions and so on. So the exact solution for the scaling dimensions of this guy, how two-point correlators decay at long distances, you would have that the exact solution is 1/8, and we get almost 1/8, we get some small error. For the scaling dimension of the energy density, it should be 1, and we get this that is accurate to 5, 4 digits, or 5, I don't know, and so on. For all the, you can see the exact numbers from CFT and in the continuum, and the numbers that we get on the lattice, okay? And this really is very old, so probably we could do better. We know we do better, yes.
Can you also get the OP coefficients?
Did we negotiate this question before? Anyway, these were just a few points in the spectrum of scaling dimensions that we can get, and we can get the OP coefficients, and this is, so there was an error in the third digit, fourth digit, I guess, yeah. So, but you can get all types of things directly from the lattice. Okay, and so more generally, we can get the central charge, scaling dimensions, conformal spin, and OP. So all the conformal data of the CFT, just by using the answers that I was describing.
Good. So this is efficient really for CFTs, right?
Yes.
Because otherwise you would have to put many tensors.
This was designed for CFTs, for scaling variables.
It's designed for CFTs.
Yes. And it can be applied. If you're not a scale invariant point, then you have different layers have to have different tensors. But the flow will be such that once you reach the correlation length in the system, if there was a final correlation length in the system, you can stop there. You don't need to correlate anymore. You reach either product state or some fixed point structure, which is it could be topologically ordered in two dimensions. You don't have to go on forever in scale. If there is a finite correlation length, then log. You take the log of this correlation length, that gives you the number of layers you need, and that's it. All right, so, I don't know. I'm running out of time, so what's the big deal with holography? Well, it's been there all the time, right? So we have space, we have scale, so we could draw the same thing in this way. where I just take the top tensor here. It's not actually the same. There are four guys coming out from this one. There are only two, but it doesn't matter. This thing is, again, a mirror, okay, where I put the top tensor in the middle and I spread the legs around. And then one thing that you can see that was also part of the design is that if you try to split this tensor network into two pieces, one containing a region of size L and the rest of the tensor network, and you do it by cutting the smallest number of legs, then you have to cut log L legs at least. Okay, that's the shortest, the smallest number of legs you have to cut to split this tensor network into two pieces, where one piece contains L spins, contiguous spins, and the other piece the rest. And so this calculation, which is it's a meta calculation, is analogous or reminds you of it's parallel to the area of minimal surface in Ryutaka Yanagi. The other observation is a two-point correlator between this point and this point. Actually, you can see that if you try to compute this within this framework, you realize that you have to jump over a number of tensors that is, again, log L, and this automatically leads to the two-point correlators decaying as a power law. And you could use this to define some distance here, and then this would naturally lead to hyperbolic. So this is a discretized version, in some sense, of hyperbolic space. Okay, so this has nothing to do with holography, except that it has a lot of flavor of holography. But I insist that this could be representing the ground states of the Ising model. Okay, so we're not at large n, we're not at strongly coupled limit or anything on the CFT side. It's a generic CFT. But nevertheless, Brian Swindle pointed out that we could try to understand the mirror as a Latin realization of ADS CFT. Of course, he had in mind that that would not be for an arbitrary CFT, but you need specific ingredients there. And since then, there has been an explosion of work in this direction, and several groups are working on that. I think we had a talk in the last 2 or 3 weeks. We had many talks on this, so Shelly Shi gave a talk on that. I think in November we had Sully, what's his name?
James
Sully. Bartek was here 2 weeks ago, we're here next week again. Dan Harlow has been also twice around. So they're using this type of construction to explore properties. So they use this as a toy model for holography. Okay. My time is over. Yeah, I need like 3 hours. Is that all right? Okay, so mirror seems to work. And there were many questions, open questions. And then the part that I won't be able to tell you about is tensor network renormalization. So, but the story here would be to start from the partition function or the Euclidean path integral and transform this. So the idea is we have an exact tensor network for this object. It's an exact tensor network. We are not approximating the partition function or the Euclidean path integral with a tensor network. It's a quasi-exact, but it's completely under control. It's not variational. Okay, you give me a Hamiltonian, we can build a representation of this form for the partition function or Euclidean path integral. Okay, and this will be given in terms of a tensor. Assume that there are periodic boundary conditions, so this guy is actually connected with this guy. And so just a single tensor in a translation invariant system, a single tensor gives you a complete description. And then there have been previous attempts to coordinate this, and I really am not going to go through that. So there. Now, so the idea is you can coordinate that, okay? Maybe some other day I'll tell you the story. But the result is that we can constrain, say, let's take now the two-dimensional classicalizing model. We take the partition function of criticality, but close to criticality, we get some, this is a flow in the space of tension. Remember before I talked about the flow in the space of wave functions, and you probably wanted Hamiltonian, so now even worse, I talk about a flow in the space of tensors, but you can really follow this flow. At criticality, you can explicitly see scale invariance in this flow. Okay, and then off criticality, you see the initial tensors are very close, very similar to each other. So what this is actually, it's imagine you have a tensor, you transform it into a matrix by joining some indices, and now you have this I don't know, I think this is a 16 times 16 matrix. And what we're plotting here is the absolute value. For each absolute value of each coefficient, we put a color. Or we choose the color depending on the absolute value. For instance, this is telling us we have zeros everywhere except in two points. And what you can see is that there is a flow into these fixed points, these two very clean fixed points. Or at criticality, there is a explicit scaling variance of the tensors. But if you look at where we started from, all these three tensors look very similar. Okay? But we are really realizing the ideas of the normalization group flow up in the space of tensors, such that we obtain fixed points for each of the cases. Good. So the good news is that when we apply this Coserine transformation to this Euclidean path integral, but now only on the upper half plane, that should be the ground state of your system, right? You take the Euclidean path integral on the upper half plane, that's a representation of your ground state. Is that something, I think you're familiar with this. Yes? So Liz, perfect. So what we can do is, this is already the ground state, okay? But now we don't know how to manipulate this. So what we can do is we can apply this Coserine transformation, and it turns out that the mirror will appear actually out of this Coserine transformation. The trick is that we have a boundary. If we didn't have a boundary, we would Coserine a tensor network into another tensor network, completely regular square tensor network. But in the presence of a boundary, there are some tensors that are left behind, and this turns out to be to lead to the mirror. So this is very different from what I said before. Before I said we start with some variational ansatz, and we're just going to use energy minimization to determine what tensors we want to have in here. Okay, all the variational parameters are determined by minimizing the energy. This is how we've been working for 10 years now. And very recently we understood that we could turn this already description of the tensor of the ground state. This is already a description of the ground state. We can turn it into a mirror. So there is no variational optimization, energy minimization. Okay? It comes up. If during the Coserine transformation you don't introduce lots of errors, this thing is going to give you a description of the ground state, guaranteed. Okay? Good. So because I don't have time, it's a slide and then I'll move. Okay, so I argue that if you have the Euclidean path integral on the upper half plane, that's the ground state. What if you just have a strip, an infinite strip of with beta, finite width beta? That is a thermal state, right? I'm sorry?
You have to identify the two boundaries.
No. I don't want to do that. These are open boundaries. So a thermal state, not a... So I really mean...
The Bain-Kadanoff etc. thing, it requires it taking the trace, no?
Yeah, I don't want to take the trace. I want the density matrix.
Oh, you want the density. Okay.
Yes, so I really want this object.
Fine, okay.
Okay, and maybe I may have to normalize it. But I want the thermal state. And so, again, what I'm saying is that this thing here is a quasi-exact tensor network representation of the object that I want. And now I'm going to apply again the Coserine transformation to this object. And because this time we have two boundaries, in the bulk of it, in the middle of it, we are considering A into some new tensor A prime and A double. But there are two boundaries, and so some tensors start accumulating there as a natural, it happens naturally as you Coserine. We're not introducing any new element. And at some point, you cannot Coserine anymore. And what we get is this meta for thermal states, which we didn't know before, we didn't have before. And then that's where are the ADS CFT people here? So then in the last week, I had to learn a lot of things, something called Penrose diagram and Parsons future singularities, which happen to be the same black hole or something. And then, so there are these diagrams where you have time in this direction. That's past, that's future. And then here you have the event horizon. And as you move in this direction, this would be, you're changing the scale of your description. And this is time, but on each point in time, you have still space, which is not represented here. And so what we could do is we could just look at a space-like cut of this. And then they tell me that they should call this a representation of the, oh, I forgot the name. Thermal field double. Yeah, thermal field double, right. So actually that would be for half beta, or I would have to half the beta. Yes. But anyway, it turns out that this thing here can be understood as a representation of this, the space-like cut of the black hole geometry, this one here, the red part, okay, where this thing here represents the Einstein-Rosen bridge. Okay, another word that I've learned. And so, you know, whatever, right? All right, so the summary is that we wanted to reformulate the renormalization group using quantum information tools and concepts, and specifically, I mean, quantum circuits and talking about entanglement and focusing on it. And the end result has been, one of the end results has been an efficient representation of ground states, especially good for CFTs, which is now being used as a toy model for holography. We wanted an energy flow for Hamiltonians. We got also one for ground states and another for tensors. From the one in tensors, we can obtain the one for ground states, and I already argued that from the one from ground states, we could get the one for Hamiltonians, so we get the whole thing. And the key ingredient was that we had to remove short-range entanglement, and that has been the guiding principle in all this story. And this works very, very nicely for 1+1 dimensional systems, which I then learned that have been solved many years ago. And so the question is, can we do this in 2+1? Can we do this in 3+1, including QCD? And because this is a quantum gravity talk, can we solve quantum gravity?
When you do this coarse graining to the wave function, it is somehow clear what you mean by removing short range entanglement, right? But if I want to do the coarse graining to a Hamiltonian, is it easy to see what does it mean to remove short range entanglement?
I'm using the same coarse graining transformation.
Right, but you have to know like beforehand what the coarse graining transformation of the state is in order to use it into the Hamiltonian. Mm-hmm. But say I give you a field theory and I want to do renormalization the proper way, which in this case would be removing short range entanglement. Is there an intuitive way of how to remove the short range entanglement looking at the operator and not the state?
In the end, you will have to try to find what low energy means in your theory.
Right.
And that may require asking the Hamiltonian and you know, asking who is the ground state. It's actually, it's equivalent to asking who is the ground state. If the system is infinite, asking low energy is the same. When you are asking this question for local regions, you should be asking who is the ground state of the whole system. So in the end, you end up asking, how can I remove entanglement from the ground state?
All right.
So okay. What about higher dimension?
Higher?
Yeah, what's going on?
You mean higher than 3+1?
No, 2+1.
Right, so
what are the results there?
Right, so there were partial results on, say, the criticalizing model in 2+1, which we were never happy with, and that has not even been published. For the longest time, we decided to stop and try to understand how to improve the whole algorithm. And now that we have understood how to constrain the Euclidean path integral, okay, mm-hmm. now it's time to think about it again. So the answer is mirror has been used to describe topologically ordered systems in 2+1 dimensions, but for critical systems, and that there has not been analogous success yet. But we are really, really excited about the recent developments since December, where we have understood how to coarse-grain the Euclidean path integral, which means we start with a representation of the ground state. We don't need to get lost in the space of variational parameters anymore. I'm talking about speed increase. The algorithms now work like 10,000 times faster, just because of this observation. So we are hoping, we think now it's time to go back to 2+1.
What about page symmetries? For instance, can you handle page symmetry in those four dimensional cases?
So you can handle gauge symmetries. The symmetry part is something that I have not discussed today, but you can, every time you have a symmetry, that's good news, because your tensors can be chosen to, you can organize them in representations of the symmetry group. For instance, if this was SG2, if you had a spin chain with SG2 symmetry, you can end up with something that looks like a spin a linear superposition of many spin nets.
Spin network.
Right. So it's a spin network, but it's not really a spin network. It's a very large superposition of many spin networks. Right. A spin network, you have to specify each representation on each index. Right. So in our construction, each index is described by a Hilbert space, which is the direct sum of many representations. And with each, okay, so not just one representation.
I'm not sure the name for that.
I can tell you later. It's getting late. So I have one more.